Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Peter Eisner about his new book, MacArthur's Spies, which chronicles the efforts of three Americans to resist the Japanese occupation of the Philippines in World War II. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. So I've been a journalist for a number of years, a foreign correspondent and an editor at Newsday, the Associated Press, the Washington Post. And I've also been on television, a couple of programs on PBS. I've been transitioning more and more toward writing books. I had a long list to write, and I've been doing that for some time. And MacArthur's Spies is one in a series of books that I've been writing about World War II.
What was it that led you to write this book? Because it's not a standard military history of the conflict. It's not a overall political history. It's something much more personal and much more nuanced, and frankly, something that, as you explain in the book, took a bit of digging to uncover.
As I said, this is the third book, and I've actually done other pieces of work about World War II. The real reason, as I have to ask myself what's going on here, is I'm the son of a Navy officer. My dad was fought in World War II in the Pacific. And like what is said about the greatest generation, it was just very true. He never wanted to speak about it very much. And I hear so many people, as I travel around, agreeing with me, they know that their parents and in-laws fought in World War II, but they just know very little about it. And I think that's what really got me into working on this area of history. Another thing about it is that World War II is a period of absolutes. We could recognize an absolute evil, and we could also recognize a unity of purpose to fight that evil. And that makes for interesting stories, interesting drama. That's one part of it. Another part of it is that the books that I write, rather than being histories, I select a person who may not necessarily be well-known or known at all in history, but stands very close to a significant event in history. So the first one, for instance, I wrote was about a 20-year-old B-17 pilot named Bob Grimes, who was shot down over Belgium in 1943 and was rescued by a young group of civilian women who were out looking for pilots who were shot down and rescuing them from the Germans and hiding them and moving them back to be able to fight another day. But Bob Grimes, that character, was fighting in a major effort in the battle to retake Europe. Then I wrote a story about Pope Pius XI, who was a pope just before the start of World War II, not very well known. And my one of my main characters was a Jesuit journalist who tried to help him write material to challenge Hitler and Mussolini and anti-Semitism. So in each case, I look for a character who can be we can move along with as they go through their moral journey to do something important. And that took me to this book, MacArthur's Spies.
One of the things I like about the book is, as you say, we view World War II as a war that fits nicely into moral absolutes. And yet, as you describe in the book, these are men and women who, even though the moral absolutes are clear, the choices they face are so complicated and nuanced. And I think that comes through in all of them, but especially with your central character, Claire Phillips, who throughout the conflict had to make all sorts of decisions that were to both her intentions and to the more basic questions of her survival. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about Claire and how she had this very interesting pre-war life that you describe, which in many ways made her ideally suited for this role that she assumed during the war itself.
Indeed, the role of becoming a spy for Claire Phillips was not obvious, and it was very strange trajectory. She, when the war broke out, she was in her early 30s. She had been a nightclub singer and on the vaudeville circuit in the Pacific Northwest in the 1920s and 1930s. And she'd actually been married a number of times that I finally discovered at least three or four times, and I couldn't discover many of the divorces. So she was rather interesting person in that respect. She went off to the Philippines in 1938, and it was a good moment to go to the Philippines, which at the time was an American Commonwealth, and there were a number of expatriates there. And she went looking for work as a nightclub performer and found it. After a year or two, she found herself, after traveling around a bit more, back in Manila in the fall of 1941 with the sense around the Pacific that the Japanese were about to provoke the war that later came. And nevertheless, saying that wouldn't happen to her, that wasn't a problem, she remained and found herself caught in Manila on December 8th, 1941, across the international date line. It was, for the rest of us, it was December 7th, the day of infamy. And as many people don't focus on and don't realize, just a few hours after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Manila and the Philippines came under attack by Japanese planes. Claire fled to the hills, and the story really begins, and her change in her life really begins when she runs off to the hills of Bataan and for the first time is doing more than an observer. She becomes a part of fighting the war slowly.
Now, she doesn't run to the hill just out of, she's not, you know, escaping bombing Manila necessarily. She's not seeking to become a guerrilla. As you described, she is engaged in an act of self-preservation. But as you explained, she's also involved in this relationship with this soldier that proves to be very important in terms of her identity. And it's a very powerful motivation for her early on in the war.
Yes, indeed. Claire, in fact, her name Claire Phillips comes from the young American private that she met in those final weeks before the start of the war, John Phillips. She followed John Phillips up into Bataan as his unit went in retreat under orders from General MacArthur. Just within a few days of MacArthur's order that the 10 to 20,000 American regulars and another 50 to some odd thousand Filipinos retreat, the man that she called her husband, John Phillips, was off into the hills as well, and she was trying to track closely his movements along with him as the retreat continues.
And as you explain, this decision to follow him, which was one that she did, it wasn't just her, it was also her adopted daughter, Diane. But it was one that preserved her from the fate of so many other Americans that were in Manila when it fell to the Japanese in December of 1941. One of the ones that you identified, and I should explain, you're focused upon three Americans in particular, you actually have several others that play very prominent roles in your narrative, and also quite a few Filipinos. And one of them that stands out is Roy Bennett. I was wondering if you could explain a bit about him and his fate, which was both typical of so many Americans once the Japanese took the city, and also an example of the extent to which the extremes the Japanese occupiers sometimes went to.
Sure. So let's take a look at the timeline. The Japanese attacked Manila the same within hours of Pearl Harbor, December 8th, it's clear to General MacArthur, who is in charge of U.S. forces in the Philippines, that there's no possible way to defend against a full expected attack by the Japanese. For all intents and purposes, supply lines and battle lines have been sliced in half by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. So, from the 8th to the 24th, just a little more than 2 weeks, it's clear that eventually MacArthur is going to go into a retreat mode to try to protect his forces. There are a number of other people in Manila that become prominent in my story, they become especially prominent after the retreat, which is December 24th. Claire runs off as well up to the hills. John Phillips has run off to the hills. And then on January 2nd, 1942, the Japanese march unimpeded and unopposed into Manila itself. There are three other characters to mention. One is Roy Bennett, as you mentioned, who is the editor of the most important English language newspaper in Manila and one of the most important in Asia, the Manila Daily Bulletin. Bennett has been railing against the Japanese throughout 1941 as relations with the United States collapse, warning that the Japanese military leaders are creating a war machine that will leave the Philippines undefended and in great danger. And he becomes more or less like a Cassandra figure in his warnings that go unheeded. Along with General MacArthur, he's been trying to rally Washington to send more and more reinforcements, which just don't come through. So January 2nd, when the Japanese march into town, the final edition of Roy Bennett's newspaper is possibly only 4 pages, with an editorial in which he says, "This is the day. There's little more that can be done. Be calm, be careful, and we have no idea what's coming." And he is one of the first Americans that is rounded up by the Japanese, and some thrown into prison and tortured, the majority of them civilians who are gathered up and sent to a detention center at the centuries-old University of Santo Tomas, which is in central Manila. So there you have it. Thousands of Americans being gathered up, most of them civilians that are just being put into detention. Roy Bennett immediately seized and taken to a torture center where he suffers many months before he can be released. And very few of the Americans are able to escape. But Claire Phillips, wisely, probably, and also in her nature, rather than being one of the civilians rounded up and put in a civilian detention center, she's run off and she's in the hills, maybe 50 to 75 miles north of Manila, where she starts to tend to the sick and wounded among the Filipinos who are under the gun as shrapnel and bombs fall all around them.
Another American who escapes detention is Peggy Utinski, and she has a story that's in many ways just as remarkable in terms of Peggy's, in terms of Claire's. I was wondering if you could explain how it was that she evaded detention and how she ends up playing a role in Claire's life as the occupation goes along.
Peggy Utinski, another American, had been in Manila for quite a long time, serving as a nurse. And by the time of the attack by the Japanese, she's working with a doctor who's tied in with the Red Cross. She immediately, as Claire starts to adapt a different ID and fake identification, and is taken to be not an American, but with her Slavic name and with fake documents, she's thought to be a Lithuanian, which is a country that's on the side of the Nazis and therefore the Japanese, and people who are of the Axis powers then would not be detained as the Americans would, although she speaks like an American and such. So Peggy remains in Manila, actually hiding for weeks in her apartment, finally starting to sneak out, puts her life together, makes contact again with her Red Cross doctors, and starts working and serving to help people that eventually become prisoners of war, and providing health services to them. So there she is, another American who might have otherwise ended up in detention, who's operating with a fake ID and serving the effort against the Japanese.
One of my favorite stories that you describe in there is when she is being interrogated by a Jaffe soldier who is pressing her on this fake identity of hers, and he asks her how to say that she is a nurse in German. And I was wondering if you could recount that story, because it gets to both, I think, sort of the advantages that they had in dealing with for occupiers of a different culture, and also how flimsy sometimes their facades were.
Right. So finally, after working with the Red Cross for such a long time, one day a Japanese soldier comes along and sees her and just assumes this is American, and starts screaming "American, American, American," and she says, "No, no, no, no." The doctor starts saying in Japanese, "No, she's a nurse, she's a nurse." And so the Japanese slows down and says, "Well, how do you say nurse in German then?" And she thinks very fast, and she doesn't speak a word of German. So she basically says Deutscher Nursi. Deutsch she knows, and nursi is the only thing she could come up with, and she figured that Japanese wouldn't know any more than she did of German, and she gets away with that by saying Deutscher Nursi, which is, she later then decided it would be a good idea to find out what the word was in German, but she got away with it, and she eventually was interrogated briefly but nothing compared to others.
Now, what we've been describing up to this point are civilians, and there was also, though, a very large military element that the defeat of the American forces, the surrender, did not include all Americans. And you recount the resistance that develops to the Japanese, but you focus in particular upon these two very remarkable people, one of whom is a naval reservist named Chick Parsons, and this other relatively anonymous figure named John Boone, who comes to be a play this vital role, not just in the insurgency, but in Claire's life.
Yes, and one of the other parts of the story that became so important to me was to use the story of these two men, Chick Parsons and John Boone, to show something that people don't really know anything about, other than people that are closest most to the story and their own relatives, that people have heard of the Bataan Death March, which in fact was the result of the greatest U.S. military surrender in history, but in which hundreds of Americans and thousands of Filipinos died marching from capture to a prisoner of war camp. But few people know that not everyone surrendered. That there were hundreds of Americans and many more Filipinos that rather than surrender, were either caught offline or just simply fled into the hills and regrouped in the course of 1942 and created an impressive series of guerrilla units that coalesced and were able to attack, harass, and help MacArthur in his struggle to get back to the Philippines. Throughout the course of the war, they were able to continue operating, though hunted down, sometimes attacked and in great danger. They were never stopped. And so John Boone was one of those men who was an army corporal up in Bataan, ran off to the hills, healed his wounds, and was one of the earliest people to put together a guerrilla band. Several months after doing so in the spring of 1942, through an intermediary, a priest who is an intermediary, he learns that there's an American woman in the hills tending to the sick and wounded. And at the same time, this intermediary tells Claire Phillips that there's an American soldier in the hills trying to put together guerrilla units. And they finally meet in the spring of 1942. And Claire is still looking for John Phillips, her boyfriend, who by now has been shipped off further north, and she loses track of him early in the first few days of the war. And hoping that maybe John Boone would know something about him. But much more important, this relationship develops, and Boone says, you could serve us in an amazingly important purpose, which would be to go back down to Manila and help provide intelligence to us, ship it back up into the hills, and we'd be able to work together to fight the Japanese. And she decides to do that. So Boone is one of the people, but the other person to mention is a fabulously interesting person, Chick Parsons, who has been living in Manila for basically since childhood on and off. Parsons is a businessman, import-export. When the war breaks out, he's been running a company that imports and exports heavy metals, foodstuffs, and such. In fact, his company is a Japanese company. Few people realized that at the same time that he was doing all of these things, and by the time everybody knew him pretty well in the Philippines, as a very popular polo player. He also had was in the Naval Reserve as a submariner. So on December 8th, he's called into headquarters and is sworn in back into the regular forces of the Navy. He's a bit older now than most others. He's in his early 40s, but he's a tough guy. And he's sworn in and designated as a spy. So here you have the three characters. Claire Phillips, who has run off to the hills. John Boone, who's starting a guerrilla band. And Chick Parsons, who's setting up as a spy in Manila. And, of course, there's an amazing further story about Chick Parsons, which eventually brings him to be in contact with both of those other two people, quite improbably, which is that he decided to stay in Manila when the Japanese invaded and was able to use his status as an import-export person to declare himself not an American, but as the Spanish honorary the Panamanian honorary consul in the Philippines, therefore receiving diplomatic recognition for himself and his family with a wonderful scene in which the Japanese, rather than arresting him, bow and say, sorry for any inconvenience, sir, and the Panamanian flag flying out front of his house, him no longer speaking English in public, speaking only Spanish. And here you've got Chick Parsons, who's developing himself as a master spy right under the nose of the Japanese. So it's an interesting, fabulous array of characters.
Yeah, I like how when the Japanese finally drive him out of the Philippines, they don't do it by arresting him or interning him. They do it by putting him on a boat with a bunch of expatriates, and he gets to sail right back to the United States. Although, as you explain, as soon as he gets off the boat, he has a rather unwelcome reception courtesy of the FBI.
Indeed. Parsons has been able to operate and gather information for the first 6 months of the war until June of 1942, when finally the first internationally sanctioned exchange ship leaves the Philippines, headed for first for Taiwan and eventually Hong Kong, and then the Japanese exchanged their diplomatic and civilian international organization prisoners with the Americans. And Parsons, who actually is smuggling information out in a very harrowing way, leaves Manila in the first few days of June with his children and his wife, and they take a circuitous route through China, and then a new ship that takes them to the coast of Africa, Rio de Janeiro, northward. And after about a 2 month journey, Parsons arrives in with his family in New York Harbor in August. And the FBI, which is out looking for spies, sees him as someone that they don't know who he is. He says he's someone named Chick Parsons. Chick Parsons on their records is listed as missing in action, and he's immediately put into detention as a spy for a number of days until finally he's able to make contact with the Philippine government in exile, along with the Navy Department, that says, let him go and send him to Washington, for heaven's sake. And by September 1st, 1942, Parsons is back in uniform at the Pentagon and trying to see what he can do to help the war effort.
I like how as soon as MacArthur gets this information, he basically sends this telegram saying, send me Chick Parsons. And he goes right back and continues to cultivate this network of contacts and this effort to maintain the insurgency.
A lot of people don't realize that General MacArthur had been in Manila himself for a number of years before the war. His father had been a hero during the Spanish-American War in Manila. He spent a lot of time there as a young man and was brought back in the early 1930s to run the Philippine Constabulary Army. And in that period, he and Chick Parsons got to know each other socially, and MacArthur certainly knew Parsons' capabilities. And at that time, MacArthur had first moved with his men to Bataan, and then was ordered by President Roosevelt in March to withdraw from the Philippines and set up the offensive response to the Japanese from Australia. So MacArthur then, starting in April, is running Southern Pacific headquarters in Australia, and eventually starts hearing radio messages that are coming across from the Philippines that there is in fact a guerrilla insurgency, and he has no way to assess it, no way to deal with it. And around that same time, word comes through that Parsons is in fact safe out of the Philippines and in Washington. So then comes through that telegram, send Parsons immediately. And Parsons is standing before MacArthur just after July 1st, 1943, with a request that's more like an order. Get back to the Philippines and let's figure out what's going on with this guerrilla insurgency. And MacArthur's request received, Parsons within a month is running a submarine insurgency operation out of Australia that runs throughout the war, that really changed the face of what was going on in the Philippines. A remarkable operation called Spyron. Dozens of secret submarine trips, tons of materiel being moved in, spies moving back and forth, and meanwhile on ground in during these trips, Parsons is organizing this amazing guerrilla insurgency.
By the time he starts doing that, Claire already has her own operation up and running in Manila. I was wondering if you could explain how it was that she was able to come back to Manila and begin this remarkable operation out of the Tsubaki Club.
As mentioned, John Boone had asked her to go back down to Manila, and he helped her get back down to Manila along with some of the friends that she'd been living with those months in the hills. Though she was attending to the sick and wounded, she herself was by now ill with malaria and a series of other tropical diseases. But she eventually, getting back to Manila, she's nursed back to health, and then she has the ability to use her presence. Having had one of her other marriages, she was actually married to a Filipino all the time while she was chasing after John Phillips. She's able to declare herself as a Philippine national by marriage, and still not detained. And rather than maintaining a quiet lifestyle, not her style at all, she decides to open a nightclub and follow through with what Boone suggested. She opens Tsubaki Club. Tsubaki means the flower camellia in Japanese. And in October of 1943, sorry, until October of 1942, it opens Tsubaki Club, catering to Japanese officers and high-class Filipinos who work with them in a prominent location not far from the docks where the Japanese ships come in and out. And she has put together an operation which includes a lot of beautiful young women whose job is to circulate among the Japanese officers as the floor show goes on. Claire singing, some of the hostesses double as dancers and singers. There's beautiful music, American standards, Hawaiian band and such. And what they do is collate little scraps of information. Where are you going? They ask. Don't leave me, they ask the soldiers, smitten with love by beautiful women. And at the end of the night, gathering up names, locations, destinations, they're able to put together an excellent list of names and intelligence material, which they then are able to periodically send up to John Boone in the hills to fulfill the job of trying to oppose fight the Japanese and eventually send information on to MacArthur back in Australia.
As you explained, though, they don't just send information to Boone. They're actually using the club to help finance him, not just directly, but also by buying a lot of the medical supplies and other goods that he and his men in the hills need to fight the Japanese. So the situation, which I found to be hilarious, of how the Japanese are fighting this insurgency, and yet they're also unwittingly helping to finance it.
It's true. John Boone was able to send down regular requests for the type of material he needed. Anything from carbon paper to pencils and typewriter. Claire even tried to get him the parts of a radio transmitter, which never quite worked out, but she tried. And along with that, medicine, food, anything she could possibly get up to him. And at the same time, she was using the funds she gathered together to provide food and medicine and also morale support to the prisoners who had survived the horrendous Bataan Death March, who were in a camp called Cabana Tuan, about 75 miles north of Manila. And a combination of what she was doing was really saving lives, fighting the war. And she, at the same time, she was risking her life every moment that entire period.
As you describe, it's that efforts with the POWs that brings her into contact with Peggy Utinsky. And as you explained, their relationship is complicated, is probably a both an effective and a simplified way of describing how the two women got along. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon their relationship and some of the dynamics that drove it.
It's a very interesting relationship, and I've dug into it in ways that hadn't come up in detail previously. Peggy was only about 5 or 6 years older than Claire, but Claire was just attractive, and she was a singer, and she was long-legged, and everybody liked her. And Peggy was kind of like not that. She was kind of dowdy, and people called her the old lady. And they actually had something in common, which was that as Claire was searching for her boyfriend, John Phillips, Peggy was searching for her husband, Jack, who was a civilian engineer and working with the Army. And in the end, they found out terribly early in 1943 that both men had died at the prisoner of war camp, Cabana Tuan. It was a blow for both of them. Claire wrote in her diary that she was drinking too much and she couldn't get over the suffering that of John Phillips's death. Peggy didn't seem to have any outlet for the grief that she felt for her husband, and she started drinking excessively, becoming dangerous. They had put together an underground supply operation, and Peggy was sometimes drunk or angry and fighting, and even sometimes threatening to turn them all into the Japanese. She was very so there was that element, but I think that also there was another element that became clear in comparing notes between the women during and after. Peggy was just jealous of Claire. She just couldn't understand why Claire got along so well and people liked her so much. And Peggy just, her personality just didn't lend to that. So there was a jealousy element in all of this.
I wonder to what degree that might also have played into her her affection for Diane, because you describe at a later point in the war, and we'll get to how this came about in just a minute, Peggy spends several months taking care of Claire's adopted daughter, and she develops a real affection for the young girl.
She did, and she, to the point where on two occasions, Diane has come back to Claire when Claire is free, and Claire gets back to Manila, and then again later, Diane, who was a little Filipina girl when the war starts, maybe 2 years old, and then, you know, 5 years old by the end of the war, and Claire was consternated that sometimes when she would see Diane after long pauses, Diane didn't even recognize who she was, yet Peggy had her. Later in the war for a number of months, and she just hated the idea that she had to part with her at the end of the war. She had just fallen for the child. So that was another element. At the same time, one has to say that Claire thought of Peggy as a friend, and she was the one that had to take care of as Diane, as we'll find out when Claire is not around to do it toward the end of the war because she's been captured.
And Peggy was a friend, not just in terms of taking care of Diane, but when Claire develops an ulcer, Peggy is instrumental in saving her life. In fact, you come right out and say that had it not been for Peggy, Claire probably would have died from that ulcer. And I think it was late 43.
Right. Claire collapsed at the club one night late in September of 1943. Her friends at the club knew immediately to call Peggy, who's a nurse, and Peggy was able to find a way to get her to the hospital. Not an easy task. There's no gasoline. You couldn't find a car, but managed to get her to a hospital. Managed to find the best doctor available, and nursed her back to health, which was not that easy. Claire ended up developing a case of lockjaw, and this was really dangerous. And anti-tetanus medicine was very hard to come by, and Claire nearly died and owed her life to Peggy, and never in later years always remembered, you know, no matter what anyone said about her, she owed a great debt to Peggy.
So Claire has this operation, and she has a code name, High Pockets, and she's engaging this intelligence gathering. She's gathering resources. She's making this contribution, and she's doing so right under the noses of the Japanese. I was wondering if you could explain a bit, you know, some of the tensions that she faced, and how the Japanese were trying their best to not just break down the insurgency, but to track down people like Claire during the occupation.
The Japanese were somewhat understaffed in the Philippines. They expected to have made easier work of subjugating the Philippines, which they were never able to do because of the guerrillas in the hills, and they knew there was an underground in Manila. And they were always looking for them. And so So after a while, they came to know that there was a woman named High Pockets, and or was a person named High Pockets. They had no idea it was the same person that was running the nightclub where many of them favored to go in, on their off hours. But eventually, in their gathering of information, the Japanese military police, called the Kenpei Tai, a very tough, brutal organization, sending out troops to gather up guerrillas and gathering intelligence, sending double agents to try to track people down, started to become suspicious of Claire, but she managed to avoid any attempts to track her down and to figure out who she really was. But then finally, there was a break point in which one of their runners was captured in April of 1944, which led finally step by step to many of the members of the organization being hauled in and interrogated, which in turn in early May led to Claire being confronted by the Kenpei Tai and said, "We know you're High Pockets," and they dragged her to a series of dungeons, tortured her, tried to gather information, and fortunately, in a complicated way, they only knew that High Pockets was sending food and medicine to the prisoners of war. They never realized that this same person, High Pockets or Madame Tsubaki, they never knew the name Claire Phillips, was actually sending intelligence information to someone named John Boone in the Hills. If they would have known that, she would have been murdered within minutes. So still she was sentenced to death, but her sentence was finally commuted to 10 years at hard labor, and she was imprisoned when the Japanese were finally under attack with MacArthur's return to the Philippines in 1944 and 1945. So she was released.
So she is released by the Americans when they recapture the Philippines. And she undergoes this remarkable journey in a very short period of time from being a Japanese prisoner to being an American celebrity. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on how it was that she achieved this, even though she still has this very suspicious story that has a lot of Americans questioning her, and also an alienation of some of the people she's been working with in terms of the feeling that they had that she's claiming too much credit for what they did.
Claire was released with a number of other women at a women's prison in February of 1945. She'd been imprisoned from May of 1944 to February of 1945. She and the others, everyone in Manila, but certainly people imprisoned, were slowly starving, and she was very weak and not very well at all. When she was released, she was taken to a hospital. The Americans were by now slowly they'd arrived. MacArthur had returned in October of 1944. American troops marching across the Philippines are taking control of Manila in February of 1945, though at a horrendous toll, tens of thousands of civilians dying as the Japanese resist. But anyway, Claire is in a relatively safe zone, taken to a field hospital. And as she's recovering, an American foreign correspondent named Frederick Paynton gets wind of the fact that she was an operative during the war and she had just been released, and starts interviewing her. And the story immediately becomes a bit entangled, and she starts getting stuck in over supplying details, like, for instance, who is this guy, John Phillips? Well, it's my husband. But what about the fact we know that there's a Filipino husband? And but in short, Frederick Payton writes an article that appears in Reader's Digest in May and June of 1945, just as Claire and the first released prisoner ship is just leaving the Manila, returning on a circuitous route to avoid the battles that are still going on in the Pacific, and returns in June of 1945 to Los Angeles, where by now an American Army public relations officer is waiting at the docks, and Claire and Peggy are both on the ship, but Claire is the one that they're waiting for, and she's, in the course of a month, she's become a national celebrity, and immediately is on network radio, is being interviewed, and in newspaper, and it was, and America already had been at war for a couple of years, and they, and Americans were looking for heroes, and she had become one of them, and the story starts taking up fire, and she starts believing the exaggerations that she started with one or two end up becoming more and more exaggerations, and pretty far along in the story, she starts believing a lot of the fiction that's being woven, as finally she writes a memoir with a Hollywood scriptwriter who really diverges further yet from Claire's real story. And that memoir, I was in, it was called Manila Espionage, as was intended, is the meat for a film that comes out in 1951, I Was an American Spy, which by then has almost nothing to do with her real story.
So she has this celebrity, but and she's also seeking compensation. And that's a part of the war that you don't often hear about, which is how many of the Americans after the war who participated in these efforts did seek this compensation. And here's where Peggy is able to steal a proverbial march upon her, in that she's able to get compensation, but Claire is making these claims based upon the amount of money that she has spent sustaining John Boone's operation. And this ultimately gets her into a bit of trouble, doesn't it?
It does indeed. So early in the first months after the war is over in 1946, the United States is quite magnanimous in providing funds to civilians and promising that the Filipino veterans of the U.S. Army are going to be compensated for their months of service. And Peggy files quickly, asking for money that that she spent in putting together supplies for the POWs. Remember, again, that Claire was the only one that was supporting the guerrillas. Peggy was providing food to the POWs along with Claire and their underground unit. And with that magnanimity, the United States gives Peggy thousands of dollars in restitution without any backup required. She just made a list of what she spent, and they give her the money. Claire is somewhat slower in filing for restitution. In the meantime, Congress decides that the restitution that the United States is going to have to pay is too much, and they start making it harder and harder to pay restitution. For instance, the Filipino veterans of the war suddenly are not getting paid the money that they thought they were going to get paid, and someone like Claire has a much harder time in putting together proof for the first time that she spent the money that she said she spent and that she had the money that she said she had. It's a long process, but in the end, both Claire and Peggy and their friends receive the Medal of Freedom, authorized by eventually by President Truman, but Claire is repeatedly denied her right to restitution to the point where in 1953, she sues the government for funds lost, and a very bruising four-year process takes place in federal court called the U.S. Court of Claims, in which remarkable events take place, in which all of the old friends appear to testify and see each other for one last time, Peggy, Claire, and a lot of their friends, and even John Boone, who comes in and actually supports Claire's claims to the degree to which he can. Yet in the end, Claire bitterly receives a fraction of what she thought she was owed. And at the same time, her reputation is highly questioned by government lawyers who have been comparing her to Peggy and claiming basically that the nightclub that she was running was tantamount to prostitution, and she was a person of ill repute compared to Peggy. In fact, both of the women had their problems, but both of the women were great heroes that were deserving of restitution for the monies they spent.
You mentioned that today Claire is memorialized at the U.S. Embassy in the Philippines, that they have a room named after her, her portrait hangs. It seems that in the end she gets this recognition, but her life ends rather early, and it kind of really tails off after that failed court case.
Sadly, the court case ends in 1957. She is given the minimum that she can be offered. I think it was about $1,400, which in current money is about $10,000. She probably spent a lot more, but more than the money that, provided, she, her reputation and was shattered, and she was embittered. She really never recovered from those days, and she never got a. She occasionally after that she was still on the speaking circuit, but she had little money. Her last recorded job was as a waitress back in Portland, Oregon. And little is heard of her in the mid to late 1950s until there's an obituary that appears in 1960 in a Portland in the Portland Oregonian that Claire Phillips has died at the age of 53. It was a tragedy and almost forgotten in the years since.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I have one loose end that I'm working on this story, actually. I've been working more specifically on the story of our wonderful unsung hero, Chick Parsons. And I've just been finishing up a magazine piece about Chick Parsons, which is going to be coming out in the Smithsonian that goes beyond the story that I was able to tell in the book, with new information, including an oral history that I found in which he describes his life. I could just say that Chick Parsons is kind of like this aw shucks Jimmy Stewart type character that is larger than life. And had the privilege of also talking to one of his sons, Peter Parsons, who has helped me gather up biographical information. He's a fabulous person, one of the great spies of World War II, and needs to be known better. That's in Smithsonian in the September issue. I'm also writing a book that's coming out later in the year. It's a departure, writing it with a friend who's a professor of history, and it's called Cuba Libre. It's a history of Cuba.
Well, those both sound like fantastic projects. I can't wait to read them. Peter, thank you for taking some time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
It's been my great pleasure. Thanks a lot.